Well, thanks very much for beating the tube strike. If I go quiet, don't worry, it's just that Peter Crouch has walked in and I'm starstruck. So I am here because I wrote a book about obsessive compulsive disorder. And I'm a journalist, that's what we do, we write, and I've always wanted to write a book. And when I pitched the book to people, the fact that I had OCD was a big part of the appeal, I think, because I was able to... What I wanted to do was write about the science and the history and the interest in politics and some of the controversies, which we can get onto because we are in, obviously, Sigmund Freud's former home, nearly. But it turns out that what everyone wants you to write when you write a book about OCD and you have OCD is what it's like to have OCD. And so at every point, everybody who I gave bits to said, yeah, it's good, but we just want to know more about you. You know, what happened to you in this situation? Tell us more about you. So I very dutifully filled in the gaps and wrote quite a lot about my own experiences in the book. And then, so I used to work for The Guardian, and The Guardian bought the rights to serialise it, which meant they basically got a Word file and they could choose what they printed. And they went through and very carefully snipped out all of the science and all the history and all the politics and ran 8 pages about how terrible my life has been. So I'm happy to talk about how terrible my life has been, but if you want more, just go read The Guardian. So, when I give talks like this, the audience is sometimes people who are affected personally, or maybe a family member, maybe you're just interested in the mind or mental health. If you are affected, or you have someone who is affected, and you don't want to ask a question at the end, do come up and grab me afterwards. I'll quite happily talk to people. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I do know a bit about how you can get help or what sort of help's available. And so, you know, if that's why you're here, please do. Don't be alarmed that they're recording it for the podcast.
One thought I had, David, actually, is put out your hands if you are a mental health professional of some kind, like a social worker, a psychologist, a therapist, or something like that. Okay, yeah.
I'm in the right place. I'm not here for professionals. Go on. Have you seen Peter Crouch?
No, just said to interrupt your train of thought.
I thought I would just very briefly talk about what OCD is. Those of you who just put your hands up, you know this, so sorry. But because even when I told people that I was writing the book, colleagues, you know, people who write about very hard physics, very hard biology, they didn't really know what it was. And everyone's heard of the term. And most people, because of the way it's portrayed often in the media, think that it's a behavioural quirk. But actually it's not. It's about thoughts. Very strange, distressing, unpleasant, taboo thoughts. And OCD is essentially when those thoughts don't go away. And what's interesting is that they're the kind of thoughts that almost everybody has. So I won't embarrass you by asking you to, but, you know, if I was to say to you, put your hand up if you've ever had that weird urge to jump in front of a train when the train's approaching, or to jump out of a high window, or when you're driving your car, I think, what would happen if I was just to... And those thoughts go in your head, and we remember them because they're just so odd. They're so out of place. Why would I think that? Why would I want to do that? And, of course, you don't want to do that. And in most people, those thoughts go away. And in someone with OCD, typically they don't. And when you have a thought like that stuck in your head, it's really quite unpleasant. And it's almost impossible to make it go away. You can't outthink a thought. You know, we use phrases like don't even think about it or don't give it a second thought. But to try not to think of something just seems to make it worse. And there have been some famous sort of psychology studies that have shown that. The technical term is the ironic effect of thought suppression. You know, you you try and suppress a thought, it comes back hard. If I say to you now, don't think of a giraffe, then you're thinking of giraffes. So if someone with OCD has these obsessive thoughts and they can't make them go away, what do? Well, they do the only thing that they can have control over, which is change their behaviour. And so the person with the obsessive thought about jumping off a train, for example, might take a step back from the edge of the platform. Winston Churchill had that. Winston Churchill had this thought to jump in front of trains, and when the express train came through, he would stand behind a pillar. He also, ironically for a former First Lord of the Admiralty, didn't like to travel by ship because he got the urge to jump over the side. Now, he wasn't suicidal. He was depressive, but these weren't suicidal thoughts. They were just really odd thoughts. So let's say you're that person who takes a step back from the edge of the platform and the train whistles through, and next time you think, yeah, I'm just going to take two steps back. And then the day after that, I'm just not going to get the train at all. That's how I'm going to make sure that I don't jump in front of the train. That has a huge impact on someone's life. And broadly speaking, that's the O and the C. The obsession is the thought, the compulsion is the behavioural response to the thought, and when that combines to the point where it has a severe impact on your life, then that's the disorder. So when people say, oh, you know, he's a little bit OCD because he likes to line up his DVDs in alphabetical order, or he has to make sure that the chairs are perfectly straight or whatever, they might have a little bit of O and C, but I would argue that they probably don't have the D. And it's the D which changes it from being a everyday, unusual, maybe even a quirk, into something which is a real problem and causes people real distress, and therefore a clinical issue, and therefore a mental illness. So why don't I stop there, and then we can, I mean, if you do want to ask questions or suggest things as we're going through, I don't mind if you want to put your hand up and say something, but let's see what you think first.
Okay. I mean, I think what's very valuable about your book is that it gives a very full account of the mental processes and all the ins and outs thereof, of having OCD, how it differs from other kind of categories of similar but distinctly different mental and behavioural processes. I think the thing that interests me in what you said is that your publisher kept saying, tell us more about you. And the curious thing about the book, I think, is how little there is about you in one way. Speaking in this particular forum and this particular building, there's practically nothing at all about your childhood. And there's also, there's plenty of very interesting scientific studies mentioned in the book. But there's nothing, when you discuss the causes of OCD, and I think quite rightly you accept that GWAS, the genome-wide association studies, and any other kinds of human genome project studies, as with every single human psychological characteristic, what I'm about to say now is completely uncontroversial. They have not been able to find any genes at all that have been shown to have a significant effect on anything. So heritability has not been found apart from tiny heritabilities, which would be described by the scientific community as insignificant. There are statistically significant findings, but they are like for 1 to 5% of the variants. Tiny, so small as to be worth ignoring altogether. For everything, we're dealing with schizophrenia, extreme mental illnesses, we were talking about the commonest mental illnesses, we were talking about severe depression, which actually David was telling me there is a paper apparently where they have managed to find some variants. But even if they find variants which are different in one group rather than another, it's still the case that the amount that they explain is tiny. To give you a really big example, is in the case of schizophrenia, they found, they compared around about 110,000 people without schizophrenia's genes with the genes of 36,000 schizophrenics. That is an enormous sample. And now they have incredibly sophisticated techniques in which they can look to like a million different locations on the genes. So they really have got very, very sophisticated equipment with which to look at great detail of these genes. And this was actually one of the reasons why many of you may not know what I'm saying, is because it has not been publicized. The science journalists in the newspapers have not said a word about this. And on the Today programme, this study about schizophrenia that I'm talking about was described, I kid you not, as a huge breakthrough. And when you actually went and read it, what it showed was that only 3.4% of the difference between the schizophrenic group and the non-schizophrenic group was explained by differences in genes. In other words, if this was a huge breakthrough, if anything, it showed that 96.6% or schizophrenia, to put it very crudely, is not genetic. just one moment. It's a very long, preamble to finally get around to make you ask your question. Just say that as something of an aside, but, and quite rightly, I think, you say that, you know, for, in the case of OCD, insofar as it has been specifically considered, the amount of the variance it can explain is zero. Pretty well. And indeed, my own opinion about this, and in fact I'm just finishing a book called Not in Your Genes, my own opinion of this is that actually, contrary to what the scientists call it, the missing heritability or DNA deficit, what is staring them in the face is that genes actually don't explain anything about individual difference in human psychology. But anyway, that's a bit of an aside, but it's relevant in the context of your book that there's nothing there about your childhood, nor is there anything about the evidence that OCD, the odds ratio of having OCD is much higher, significantly higher, in people who have suffered what is called childhood maltreatment. Childhood maltreatment is quite a crude term, and actually, you know, really sophisticated developmental psychopathology goes into it in much more subtlety than just that, but put very crudely means physical and sexual abuse, obviously, emotional neglect, physical neglect, and emotional abuse. In other words, the sort of thing that actually R.D. Lang described as being shown to be highly significant in causing all sorts of problems. And it means, put it very crudely, being very nasty to your children, stigmatizing them, victimizing them, double binding them, being cruel to them in all sorts of ways, emotionally. And indeed, emotional abuse is the strongest single predictor of schizophrenia, and indeed there is a huge amount of evidence that schizophrenia now is quite clearly caused to a very considerable extent, not by genes, as I've already said, but in fact by child maltreatment of very kind, with emotional abuse at the top of the list. Anyway, my point is, there's nothing in there about the evidence on child maltreatment. Now, you bravely, you know, you tackle the question of the role of the environment in causing OCD, insofar as you take it from a conventional cognitive psychology position, and you talk about exaggerated responsibility literature, you talk about the possibility that parents do, to some extent, pass through social learning, that ideas can be passed from parents to children. But you don't actually exemplify that in your own case. And I suppose what I'm really intrigued to hear about is, without wanting you necessarily to sort of lie on the couch and for us to go into this in huge personal detail at this point in front of this audience, but, you know, to what extent do you think that it's possible that the way you were cared for when you were small may have in fact contributed to, your propensity for OCD in general, and in particular, that your key obsessional compulsive symptom revolves around HIV, and whether you think that has, you do talk about where that starts, but why it was HIV and not something else, and perhaps its history in your family, which is what I'm afraid shrinks here, I'm bound to want to ask you. Forgive me for being so impertinent.
Wow, that's the big question.
Don't feel you have to answer it, sorry.
So my OCD is around a fear of HIV.
Yes.
And I think this is because I probably have the kind of makeup, either genetic or because of childhood experiences or whatever, that makes me more likely to develop OCD than somebody else. And if it hadn't been HIV, it might have been something else. And there's quite a lot of evidence that the topic that people become obsessed by is very influenced by culture.
Yes.
So by the end of the 1980s, HIV was appearing in something like one in three obsessions of people with OCD in the United States. In the 1960s, it was asbestos. In the 1920s, it was syphilis. You know, there were case studies in The Lancet from like 1890s of people exactly like me. Oh, sorry, I forgot I had a microphone. Exactly like me. They have obsessional, irrational fears of syphilis, both catching it and transmitting it to their families. They're tested, it's negative, they're reassured, work, and they called it phobia, syphilis phobia.
Yep.
And that was because, of course, syphilis was this big threat and was being advertised in the way that HIV was advertised as a threat in the 80s and 90s. So I think is why HIV hit me in that way and lots of other people.
Yeah.
To get into what I think your question was about, which is about causes, I think the honest answer is I don't know, because it's difficult, and this is something that they have encountered again and again with trying to piece together childhood experiences with outcomes in later life, is that you have to get people like me, it takes 10 years often for people who have been diagnosed with OCD to get help. So already there's a delay, but you get people like me who are 40s, and you say, right, what happened when you were 5? And of course it's difficult to remember with any accuracy or reliability. So to then map childhood experiences to outcomes is almost impossible on any meaningful level. The only way that you can do it is to track people from early age and ask them questions about their experiences and then track the outcomes in what's called a longitudinal study. And they have done that. And there is, so they found, for example, that smoking cannabis in the teenage years seems to be linked to a higher outcome of psychosis when people are 30 and 40. Whereas it's very difficult to get people who are 30 and 40 and say, how much cannabis did you smoke as a teenager? So you have to almost do it longitudinally in that way to make any meaningful connection between individual experiences and individual outcomes. I think I took my lead from, I was in group therapy, and there were 6 people in my group, and 3 of us had obsessions about HIV. And we were all completely different people, different class, different gender, different sex, different background, different experiences, everything about us was, you wouldn't have said these 2 people have a similar experience in anything. And yet we had an identical pathology. We had a problem this is true again and again and again. I get emails all the time from people who have this exact same OCD about HIV. And they're from all over the world, all cultures, all backgrounds. And I think, so even if there is a link between a particular set of childhood circumstances and an outcome, which in this case is OCD, I don't think it's not realistic that that can explain all of the cases, because it's not just not feasible that all of these people who have completely different scenarios have the same trauma or experience, and then that led to this outcome. So So what I started with was, and this is how they try to treat OCD, is that, okay, you have these symptoms. And the most important thing is to try and find a way to make those symptoms go away. And Freud and others thought and continue to think that the way to make those symptoms go away is to probe the unconscious and to find the underlying reasons which are sort of indirectly being expressed as obsession. And if you can appease or soothe those subconscious problems, then the outcome will change and the OCD will go away. There isn't a great deal of evidence that that works, and it's been tried for over a century. And so what I was mostly interested in the book was taking this approach that we have this huge burden, and let's look at how we treat it. But let's also look at, because of course the cause is important, from a scientific point of view, if not from a clinical point of view. I think if someone has breast cancer, no one's interested in how they got that. As an individual, as a society, we're very interested in preventing cancer. But if you have breast cancer, you're not asked about, you know, your exposure to, I don't know, the pill or whatever. You're just interested in what the pathology is, and how can we treat it. And I think, so that's my stance on mental illness in a way, is that there are two ways of looking at it. One is in a very sort of philosophical, interesting academic debate, which I think Freud had a big part to play in. I think he, you know, almost began that, and he was very interested in OCD. And then there is the, okay, there are people who are really suffering, because I know what it's like. I had it for 25 years. How can we help them?
Yeah.
And I think the starting point should be, how can we help them? What works? And then let's look at the causes, rather than an assumption that if you can find the cause, that is a way of helping.
Well, I think we should come to that in a moment, because I think that's a really interesting question. But the in fact, when it comes to ways of finding out about the impact of childhood on adult symptoms and personality, cognition and everything, I couldn't agree more that prospective longitudinal studies are the most effective. And by far the best one is one done in Minnesota, Alan Shruth's group, which started off with 267 at-risk mothers before they had any children at all, and then followed the children through. And they showed that in 9 out of 10 cases, because they measured everything, and it was by far the best study, because they actually looked at everything there was to look at. In 9 out of 10 cases, if they had suffered maltreatment, they subsequently suffered some kind of mental illness at age 18. And I personally think that when the money that's been spent on the Human Genome Project, which I don't regret at all, because it seems to me to prove conclusively genes are not in the picture, when that kind of money, around about $8 billion, starts being spent on prospective longitudinal studies, boy, will you see that that Alan Shruth study turns out to be very, very predictive of what's really going on. Because actually, when you knit together the many, many prospective longitudinal studies of huge variability in terms of their quality. But I mean, there's a meta-analysis of the 23 best by Veitch, which finds very strong odds ratios. And it's very much dose-dependent. The more maltreatment you suffer, the younger you suffer it, exactly as Freud predicted, although, of course, many things that Freud predicted that aren't, have been definitely shown to be not likely to be the truth. But his broad picture that early experience has a profound effect on adult personality seems to be being proven beyond much doubt. And the Veitch meta-analysis, for example, shows that the more bad things that happen to you, the younger they happen to you, the greater your likelihood of having a mental illness. And in the case of a severe mental illness, to take the most extreme example of an odds ratio based one, somebody who has suffered five or more kinds of maltreatment is 193 times more likely to have schizophrenia than somebody who suffered no maltreatment. And that's not just one, there are many, many surveys. And those are actually based on retrospective. The biggest and best retrospective study, of course, is the ACE, the Adverse Childhood Events study of 17,000 Americans, which connects very much with the prospective evidence. So I would slightly beg to differ with you about retrospection. I think retrospection is turning out to be much more powerful as a predictor than you would have thought, because it knits so closely with what the prospective evidence shows. And I would say, I would come back and say, actually, there's nothing in your book about this huge body of evidence, and I think it is not an exaggeration to say it's huge, that the way you are cared for when you're small has a very considerable effect on your vulnerability to subsequently becoming mentally ill. And I totally take your point about HIV. The details of whether it's HIV or indeed, as you say in your book, quite right, you know, very interestingly, that religion is much more likely to figure in OCD symptoms if you're in a fanatically religious cultural environment. But in a way, that's very incidental. It's kind of, you know, in other words, what we certainly seem to agree about is that something or other makes one vulnerable to becoming obsessive compulsive. And I'm saying, I think childhood has to be considered as a very strong likelihood that childhood is going to be highly significant. We can beg to differ on that.
I wouldn't differ. I think childhood clearly has an impact on personality. You know, childhood experiences are one of the biggest influences on people's personality. I suppose what I would say is that even if it was shown with exact precision that, let's say, I was sexually abused as a child, that's why I've got OCD about HIV. Now, I was sexually abused as a child, if anyone's twittering or whatever, to make that clear for the record. But how does that help me get rid of my OCD?
Well, because we don't need
to prove that sexual abuse causes OCD for it, it's not a good idea. Let's try and stamp out sexual abuse for children,
no,
whether or not it affects
OCD. For sure. But in terms of, I think there's two separate things. One important point is that the latest evidence, of which there is again an absolute abundance, because as you, again, very rightly, I think, and accurately say in your book, that the diagnostic and statistical manual and the whole psychiatric model is beginning to fall apart. And this became very apparent when DSM-5 came out. And indeed, even my colleagues in the British Psychological Society, in the Clinical Psychology Division, you can see in the Observer, E.C. Johnston et al., stepped forward and said, actually, we just don't believe any of this stuff anymore, and let's have the quotations from the guy who actually did the DSM-5. He says, I admit now that we've been waiting for, you know, decades for the biogenic evidence to come, and we're still waiting. That's what he said. The evidence that there are these discrete illnesses which are the same as in the physical realm is simply discredited. I mean, it cannot be taken seriously anymore by anybody who wants to look at the evidence. But what's interesting is that there's a load of other evidence that shows that the John Reed's traumagenic model is very much standing up, which is that if you're repeatedly subjected to unpleasant experiences from a young age, it affects obviously the size and shape of different parts of your brain. That's very well established. But it also affects your electric chemistry, and in particular the evidence that's most strongly supported is concerning the fight-flight hormone cortisol. Now, if you have if you're constantly in a state of fight or flight, you're constantly worried that bad things are going to happen, it has a big effect on your whole state of mind. And that can be expressed in lots of different ways, is to get to my point, which is that psychiatric, there's many papers I could refer you to, which now show that actually there is no single, nobody's expecting there to find any single connection between a particular pattern of maltreatment and a particular psychiatric ailment in adult life. In other words, being sexually abused can express itself in a great many different ways. Being emotionally abused can result in you becoming a perfectionist and becoming sugar, or it can sort of psychopathic, triadic, psychopath, Machiavelli, narcissist like Alan Sugar, or it can result in you becoming Lionel Messi, quite possibly. There are many different ways in which the same pattern of maltreatment, broadly, may turn out to be expressed, some of them very positive, some of them very negative. I'm totally with you on the idea that it's fruitless to search for particular patterns, although there is some evidence for externalizing versus internalizing, actually, that some kinds of childhood maltreatment make you more likely to go outwards to become aggressive or hyperactive or that sort of thing, as opposed to other kinds of experience which make you tend to go more internal. There's some evidence in the attachment literature suggesting specific links between certain kinds of parenting and certain kinds of attachment outcome, being an avoidant person rather than a resistant clinger, that sort of stuff. But broadly, I think that it's turning out that it's child maltreatment that's crucial, and that it actually can take you in lots of different ways depending on the quirks of your family culture, is what I suspect, and your wider culture, much as you're saying about you happen to be in the 1980s and HIV, your icebergs are coming towards your Mattelli in 1987 onwards. But I think the question, now, to go back to your point, what use would it be for us to know that you've been sexually abused? Well, a massive amount of use. If you knew that and you were my client, I could work wonders with you. I could cure your OCD, quite possibly. Having said that, I want to say, I want to make this big proviso from where I'm sitting. Yes, I believe in psychodynamic psychotherapy that goes into your childhood and uses the relationship with the client the client's relationship with the therapist, to give the client a different experience. And it's really about the relationship, most of all. It's not about clever cross interpretations for the most part. It's mainly about giving the person a real feeling of being looked after and that they have a different experience. However, I don't want to get carried away. But broadly speaking, there is definitely a large body of evidence that the cognitive behavioural therapy that you underwent and that is being presented to huge swathes of the country now through David Clark's IACT system. There is no doubt that in the short term, overall for anxiety and depression, people after only 6 sessions of that will tick boxes which say that they feel better and after only 6 sessions. The problem with that, of course, is that when you actually look at the long-term evidence that Drew Weston and Jonathan Shedler and others have, it doesn't last. So there is really overwhelming evidence, and I've actually had a quite detailed email exchange with David Clark and Peter Fonagy and Richard Layard about this. And they cannot present, despite all their massive resources, they cannot present me with any evidence. That it works after 2 years, that there's any difference between people who had no CBT and people who did. Whereas, when it comes to psychodynamic psychotherapy, overall, there is a very strong evidence, there's a review by a guy called Leitzenring in JAMA in 2009, of something like 23 studies, showing that there is long-term efficacy for psychodynamic psychotherapy. So, I'll just throw that into the ring. Having said that, I really do take your point that OCD is a very interesting special case, and certainly as a clinician, and I know many other clinicians who say the same, psychodynamic clinician, who would say it is a seriously difficult thing to shift. And I think that if anything, if you look at this, the scientific evidence for the efficacy of psychodynamic psychotherapy in OCD is minimal. There's not much, as it's not really been studied. In the case of CBT, as you cite in your book, there is clear evidence that in the short term, OCD you know, is the symptoms of OCD are overall diminished by CBT. There's no, and there is actually some evidence, it's one of the very few things where there is a little bit of evidence that it works long term, actually, CBT for OCD. So, don't get me wrong, I think that, you've hit on something very important in writing this book, in that you've identified a very specific, what used to be called anxiety disorder, although it's not, a very specific anxiety disorder, which seems to almost have a life of its own. It seems to be different in many ways from, say, something like generalized social anxiety, from various other kinds of anxiety. It seems to be, it overlaps in certain ways with eating disorders, with certain other problems, that also prove extremely hard to crack if you're a clinician, if you're working from a psychodynamic position. And it does seem to me that with such cases you do need to be a lot more interventionist, and you need to be much more prepared to, you know, get off your get off your psychoanalytic throne, if you like, and get down and dirty in the way that, to give them their due, CBT practitioners, see it as their job to make people better, to actually have the person walk out of the room not feeling so worried about HIV than when they came in. Whereas if you came to me, I would certainly be concerned about that, but I would be expecting this to take several years. I would not be expecting, you necessarily feel better. I might even expect you to feel worse, even, I'm afraid to say. Sometimes after some sessions, not many I would hope, but occasionally, that is what is the outcome of a session, and it's a part of the work, and so long as if you're seeing them three times or five, even five times a week, I see something like that, that's alright, you can do that. But it's not very practical, psychodynamic psychotherapy, it's very expensive. It may be argued, and indeed, where is the evidence base that it works for OCD? Not nearly as strong as CBT. I'd definitely give you that. There should be a question in there.
Well, I'll tell you something that you said that I don't know how much people realise about mental illness, but you said that people will tick boxes saying they feel better. But that is how you diagnose mental illness.
Yep.
You get them to tick boxes. Because there's no blood test, you can't test someone's heart rate, you can't measure anything in their stomach or their
brain scan,
whatever. You just can't do it. You have to ask people how you feel. And OCD, in fact, is diagnosed with exactly that. You actually do tick boxes. There's 10 questions, and there are things like do you have recurring thoughts? Never, often, all the bloody time, tick that, right? You actually get 3 points for that. And then it's like, how often do you spend engaged in rituals? Never 1 to 2 hours, 4 to 6 hours, all the bloody time, tick that one, another 3 points. And then you work your way through, and then to out of 40, if you get, 20, you've got OCD. And so it's not, the idea of ticking boxes is not necessarily that it's superficial.
Well, in the case of OCD.
That is an assessment, and that is a clinical assessment, and that is also how you show people are either recovering or not. So I think, I would put it like this, that in the, OCD, or certainly the kind of thoughts that lead to OCD, they're not a new thing. These thoughts, these ideas, this distress that it causes have been around for as long as we've been keeping records. There are reports of these weird thoughts going back to, the eighth century or even earlier. There's a book, the Book of Marjorie Kemp, which is supposedly the first sort of autobiography written in English, and it's just been recently digitised at the British Museum. It's sort of written in the 15th century, 16th century. And in there, she describes these terrible, intrusive thoughts. And in the Middle Ages, if I'd gone to it would probably have been a priest in those days, or a religious figure anyway, with my anxieties, they might have performed an exorcism, you know, or I might have been burnt at the stake as a witch. And then in the early 20th century, along came Sigmund Freud and his ideas of the unconscious, and so they would have asked me about my childhood experiences, and they would have talked to me about those. In the 1940s, I would have been given a lobotomy. You know, bits of my brain would actually have been cut out. And now, in the 1990s, well, actually, I missed a stage. In the 70s and 80s, it was all about behavioural psychology, and I was actually given, I first went to a psychiatrist in the mid-90s, and he gave me an elastic band to snap against my wrist every time I had a thought. And at every case, at every stage in history, no one thought, oh, this is a really bad idea, let's try it. They all thought that was the explanation.
That's it. Yeah.
It was down to evil spirits.
Yeah.
Or it was down to subconscious trauma. Or it was down to parts of the brain misfiring, well, let's just cut them out. Or it was down to learned behaviour which could be reversed with thinking. And now, I do agree, there is the latest sort of, because those treatments or those ideas reflect the technology and the ideas of the time. And now we have brain scans and we have ability to probe genetics. And so of course that is an explanation that people are looking at. All of which is interesting ideas about where this problem might come from. But as I said, what matters to me, as someone who's had OCD, is that I leave feeling better than I went in. Now, granted, the impact does not always last, and with CBT, it gives me a set of tools that I use all the time. But the idea, or certainly with OCD, Freudian ideas about psychodynamic therapy, I mean, I'm not disputing the interesting theory, but the idea that it could be converted into a workable therapy meant that by the 1980s, people just said, we can't treat OCD.
Yep.
We just can't treat it. Sorry, go away.
Yep.
And now, we can. Now, it doesn't always work, and it doesn't work for everybody, but we don't necessarily understand fully the theoretical basis for a lot of this, certainly the drugs that they give people. We don't understand why they work, but they just seem to work. And that's meant there's never been a better time throughout history to be born with OCD.
On that note, I think it might be time to start to open to the floor. I'm going to be really cheeky and ask the first question, if I may. And then we'll have a roving mic, so I'm going to come round to you. I suppose one thing that's really interesting about the book, and I think it's fair to say you are quite negative about Freud and where the Freud Museum, so let's be controversial. One of the interesting things is that, of course, Freud often gets lampooned, perhaps, about the idea of there being kind of sexual contents in obsessional thoughts, and, you know, it giving rise to, you know, the kind of cliches of Freud kind of forcing sexual interpretations onto the patients and so on. One thing that's very interesting about your book is that, one thing that's very interesting about psychoanalysis and psychotherapy is that the story that's privileged when it comes to obsessions is very much the patient's story or the sufferer's story. And you give an account of a very interesting kind of onset of your OCD symptoms, which does involve a sexual scene.
Yes. Now you've got everyone interested.
Would you like to take us through it?
So I went to, if you've read the book, apologies, you'll know this already. I went to university, I met a girl and we went back to her place. The next day my friend said to me, so did you have sex with that girl? And I lied and said that I had. And then the response was, and this tells you a lot about the culture at the time, you could have AIDS. Now, I knew that I actually couldn't, because I hadn't. But then a few months later, that thought came back, the idea came back, and I remember, I don't, you know, some people are uncertain about when they felt worse. I can remember I could give you the exact date, I could tell you what I was wearing, I could tell you what the weather was like, I could tell you what music I've been listening to that day. I remember, because it was the moment that my life changed, and it was summer, and I was drunk, and I was walking home to my parents' house, and I remember describing it in the book, because it was a really hot summer's night, and this thought came, you could have AIDS. And it was so out of place, it was so crazy, it was so irrational, that it was as if a snowflake had fallen from the sky in the middle of the summer. And I couldn't make it go away. That was my thought, that was my intrusive thought. Now, it's a sexually transmitted disease. So I'm not sure how much we should read into the sort of the sexual nature of it, but I do grant you that a lot of the thoughts that get stuck in OCD are taboo topics. They are, you know, disease, death, sex. And some of the thoughts that people have, Freud would have a field day with them. Because people do get obsessed with thoughts that they might hurt their own child. You know, people know about postnatal depression. It's very commonly diagnosed now, but most people don't know there's postnatal OCD, and that it's a very acute time for people, and it's terrible. You know, you get mothers and fathers who have just got a newborn baby, and they can't pick it up because they have this thought they're going to hurt it, they're going to drown it, and they can't bath it because they're going to drown it. And imagine going to your GP and saying, hi, I have these thoughts about drowning my baby. Now, you're never going to do it. But how can you say that to somebody? And so, you do kind of suppress it, and so there are, you know, elements of all this. And this is why, me to say that, I think Freud has some interesting ideas, and certainly, he was really onto something with the power of the unconscious. Yeah, I mean, without question, that in OCD it is very apparent that there's something ticking along in the back of my head that I'm not fully aware of, which comes out now and again with crazy thoughts. You know, they don't just appear out of nowhere. There's something going on deep down. But just coming back to the reason I'm critical of Freud is mainly because he was so influential that his ideas dominated the treatment of OCD for 100 years. And there's not a great deal of evidence that it was particularly successful. But I do acknowledge that, that there is certainly something in this ideas that we suppress, and thoughts that we suppress, and thoughts that we don't want to vocalise. So I suppose what's different is where those thoughts come from. I'm not sure you need to invoke a particular set of circumstances in childhood to explain it, because everybody seems to have these thoughts. The question is why they stick in some people and not in others.
But is it not the case that, given that there is really strong evidence that all kinds of mental illness are associated strongly with child maltreatment, the more extreme maltreatment, the younger, the more extreme the mental illness, and including OCD.
does it not, I don't know, I find it interesting that, do you not think it would be worth, I mean, you do mention in the book that you go and see a counsellor, and it's a waste of time, which I can understand, it would be. I can imagine counselling for OCD where they just sort of Rogerian counselling where they repeat the last four words of...
That's not Rogerian counselling.
Well, Carl Rogers was the person who put forward the notion that you say the last four words of the...
No, you did. No.
So you did.
It's much more
complicated. Oh, I'm not saying Rogerian counselling is all bunk, blah, blah, blah. All I'm saying is that for OCD in particular, I can understand if you went to a counsellor who just sort of smiled benignly at you and tried to be nice and maybe asked you about your childhood a bit and you went a few times, I can easily understand that that wouldn't have had a huge effect. But what I'm talking about is proper modern psychodynamic psychotherapy, which is, you know, obviously it's ultimately has its roots in Freud, but is now a considerable distance away from, you know, it's not about the Oedipus complex or anything like that, for the most part. It's about attachment, etc., depending on the particular inclination of the therapy. But, and most of all, it's about the relationship with the therapy. But it is about what actually happened in your childhood. And I would have thought, if I had OCD, I would be very curious. Goodness knows I've had my problems, and I've got God knows how much so in my time. And some of it's been a total waste of time, I have to say. But you know, I do think that if I had OCD, I would at least want to give it a shot. I'd be interested to know whether what happened in my childhood might have something to do with it, and whether knowing about that could actually change the nature of my cognitions. Because you're very much buying into the cognitive model, which is that, you know, cognitions precede everything else. Whereas obviously the Freudian or the psychoanalytic model has it pretty much the other way around. And particularly, you know, childhood as well as emotion driving cognition. You know, and the idea that cognitions have meaning, that the cognitions are symbols, that they symbolise something, and that a lot of that has its roots in childhood. But it doesn't, obviously not, but you don't really think that you want to go there. You don't see the point.
I think I'm... I went to the GP.
This is what you do if you've got an illness, right?
Yeah.
And I reached the point where I was going to do anything that they told me. Because I'd reached rock bottom and I started to involve my baby daughter in some of my fears about HIV, and I said, right, this has to stop. I'll do anything. Go to the GP. Right, okay, give you these drugs. Yeah, take those drugs. Do they work? Don't have to take them. That's what they say. Don't drink on these drugs. Okay, didn't drink for a year. Go and do this CBT. Okay, CBT person says, next time you cut yourself, I want you to go find your baby daughter and smear her in your own blood. That's the point I was at. And I came out of that, as the evidence suggests, lots of people do, feeling better. And I'm now at the point where people say to me, it's not cured. I manage it. I have good days and I have bad days, and I say to people that's a lot better than only having bad days.
Yeah.
So I've got to the point where the disorder does not dominate my life in the way that it used to, and I'm alright with that. I'm well aware that there are things in my past that could be providing unpleasant echoes and all that stuff, just as there are with almost everybody, but I've got to the point where I can get through the day without crippling anxiety that there might be HIV on this chair, which is what I had for 20 years.
Yeah.
At this point, I'm going to open up for questions. What I suggest is that I know that there are lots of people who are really keen to ask something. I think that we'll take three or so questions, and then we'll go back to David and Oliver to discuss, and we'll do that a few times, okay?
Hi, just on the, sorry, we've been talking about genetics and heritability method. So genome-wide association study, so they look for associations between single genes and a condition. We've got 25,000 different genes, so the finding that no single gene causes a particular condition is not the same as the finding that is not genetic. There are twin studies as well, so looking at the difference between monozygotic and dizygotic twins, and basically on the basis that twins have got shared environments, so monozygotic, so identical twins, are much more likely to have the same condition. And my understanding was that they show quite a big difference between monozygotic and dizygotic, suggesting that there is a heritable component, it's just not attributable to any one gene. Rather, the next generation of genetic studies looking at patterns of covariance across multiple genes. And just on the point about the environment, so all mental illnesses are associated with much higher rates of early childhood adversity, but two people can have an exactly equivalent level of early childhood adversity. One of them goes on to develop a problem, the other doesn't. And the idea, as I understood it, was that the difference between those is genetic. So and we're thinking about gene-environment interactions, you know, rather than kind of it's either one or the other.
No, well, actually, just to clarify that, the GWAS, I'm almost certain that you're wrong, that the GWAS are not just looking at for an individual gene that correlates with a particular mental illness. No, they're looking right across at groups of genes. They're looking at gene variants. For example, in the schizophrenia study I mentioned, they found 108 variants. And these 108 variants, and that's what they've been doing now for a long time. This is not a new thing. They've been doing it for a really long time, and they heralded it. This is going to be the answer to solve the missing heritability problem. It hasn't. It really hasn't. And then now, very soon, this will be proven beyond doubt what I'm saying is true, which is the whole genome sequencing, where they can take all 3 billion SNPs, and they can actually look at all 3 billion of each individual in large samples, the comparative samples, and I would bet you my house that they, and actually they know damn well what they're going to find, is exactly the same as what they've already found. It's quite obvious, because they've already looked everywhere where it's likely to be significant. The genes that code for proteins are just not showing anything. As regards twin studies, the interesting thing is, if you read Jay Joseph's book, The Trouble with Twins, it has long been quite clear that twin studies are deeply flawed. And the problem with twin studies, and I think this is what is going to be eventually accepted, is that twin studies quite simply confuse the fact that identical twins are treated much more similarly than non-identical twins. And that is a well-established fact. So the equal environments assumption has been falsified, it has been shown, that identical twins are treated more similarly than non-identical twins. Surprise, surprise, since they look identical. And the reason, of course, that is fed back against that is to say, but they're treated more similarly, including whether they get sexually abused or not. They're treated more similarly because of their genetically inherited traits, not their physical appearance, but that is the counter-argument for which there is bog-all evidence. And I personally take the view that the Human Genome Project has actually proved that twin studies are simply a measure, that the supposed heritability in twin studies are actually measures of the shared environment, that they are simply treated more similarly, and that is why they come up more similar.
Just on the genetic thing, I think, are you a geneticist?
But
as I understand it, you're kind of both right. As I understand it, what a GWAS does is it finds regions in which there is common variability, and it'll say, okay, so this region, which is on this, the end of this chromosome, is a bit different, but it does not necessarily follow that that region is part of an active gene. You know, because the genome is like this long, and the genes are these bits here, and if you find a variation in this bit, which is not in a gene that we know makes this protein, it does not mean that it's genetically, it does not show that it's not a genetic condition, but equally it doesn't show that it is. It just shows that something is going on which these people have in common, which shows up in their genomes.
But the variance it explains is virtually nothing.
Which just correlates.
Every single study when they try to convert this into heritability, and I mean every single study, what I'm saying isn't a sort of controversial statement. Every single study, there's been 115 of mental illness by 2011, and therefore another whatever since. Every single one, they can't come up with heritabilities beyond it. They can find 108 variants, but it only explains 3.4% of the heritability, in terms of heritability. There has to come a point. The interesting question, the scientific paper I wrote about this, which was published last year, was the question was, what will it take for us to accept the null hypothesis of the Human Genetic Project? And I put that to you as a science journalist. Only you, science journalists, can start writing about this, because it's blatantly obvious that the null hypothesis is staring us in the face, but hardly anybody is even considering it.
We've got quite a number of questions to get to, so I'm going to stay over here. I think there's next, and I'll come back to you in a moment.
So I'm interested because you talk a lot about sexual abuse, physical abuse, mental abuse, and I think within the case of OCD itself, a lot of what, as in you said, you didn't mention much about your childhood. With me, my CBT therapist has told me many a times she thinks it's to do with responsibility, rather than, so you're focusing more on this physical sexual abuse. I think it's more to, I wondered whether you'd think it was in the way, say, if you had it, rather than these kind of abuses, a turbulent childhood or a childhood where things have not been stable, or, so in my case, I had a very strong relationship with my parents, but my childhood was extremely turbulent and extremely uprooted, and I went through a lot of unnormal experiences, let's say. So I was interested, I know these things though, and I agree with you in a way when you say, how can this now help me? I know these things, and I know, and a lot of the times I'm told, oh, so you think it's about responsibility. So as an OCD, you said the question was asked by you, whether it was because his OCD was about sex. I think it's more about positions of responsibility, so it's to do with your body, with to be responsible with it, or a lot of people have, you know, this kind of fear of hurting their children because it's places of high responsibility. And I wondered whether you thought this was connected to whether, if you're in your childhood, you saw your parents acting in irresponsible ways, and how, knowing this, how can this help you to try and overcome your specific OCD, if you know this information, if you see what I mean?
So, I can only go on what I know from reading about this, but, so, this idea of an inflated sense of responsibility is what they call a cognitive dysfunction. You know, it's like a common way of thinking which is not ideal because it doesn't lead to the right outcomes. So, for example, if a child, and we do tend to pick up these things in childhood, you know, and let's say, you know, your mum says to you, look after your baby brother. I'm just going to the shops. And your baby brother picks up a knife, stabs himself in the head and dies. And that's going to have an impact on you as a child. It wasn't your fault. Nothing you could have done about it. But you could see why that would change the way you might think about responsibility. The problem is that is a, it's not, to have an inflated sense of responsibility is not a mental illness. It's a personality type. It might lead you to make bad decisions or bad judgments. But not everybody who has that develops OCD in this case. So, it's almost like when we talk about the genetics. It's unlikely, even when you start to get into psychological mechanisms, that you can make a direct map. It's more likely to be that maybe you've got a bit of genetics that contributes to a certain way of brain circuitry. Maybe you've had a background in which something has happened which has made you question your responsibility, or you need to feel more responsible for things. And then something happens, and throw it all into the mix, and you get this OCD. And what the kind of the theory is that what happens to you is these intrusive thoughts, which everybody has, and because you have this inflated sense of responsibility, you interpret those thoughts differently.
That's the
cognitive model for OCD.
No, I understand, but I was wondering more whether it's this is a predisposition, whether that means obviously people have had turbulent childhoods and then not go on to develop these responsibility OCD kind of thoughts, but I just thought, like, if you said this is, if you have OCD, that would be the first thing you want to find out. This was the first thing that I kind of did find, and it has this information.
Yeah.
Was not.
But you've got, unfortunately for you, you got a cognitive behavioural therapist. That's your misfortune. If you had a psychodynamic psychotherapist, they would give you a completely different experience from your turbulent childhood. And through the relationship with the therapist, your brain would change, actually. There would be changes in your cortisol levels in particular. And your pattern of attachment would change. That's a well-demonstrated phenomenon, that good psychotherapy changes your pattern of attachment from secure, from insecure to secure. As a result of that, the OCD would merely be a symptom of a much broader set of problems, and it would become, if the therapy was done really well, and it would take a long time, it would take, 2-3 years of frequent visits, but, or you've been doing on Skype actually nowadays quite a lot, I do an awful lot of work on Skype, it's through the relationship that you actually really do change. You actually become a different person, because the turbulent childhood is now in the past, and you have properly metabolized it. And you no longer talk about the return of the repressed. The turbulent experiences, which are constantly, as in PTSD, the traumagenic model, is essentially that pretty well all mental illness is best understood as a kind of PTSD. And the likelihood is that your turbulent childhood has left you very, has changed your physical state, and that is as the most prominent and the biggest way in which that's interfering with your life is the OCD symptom. But that would only be part, and as with most people who have emotional problems, they are comorbid with other problems, depression and other kinds of anxiety and so on. That would be the model that I would be working from as a psychodynamic psychotherapist, and I would have a high hope, depending on the nature of the turbulence and depending on, all sorts of factors, but and whether or not you formed a good transference to me, whether I did a good job, I would expect you to cease to have OCD eventually.
Hi, going back to the experience of having OCD, I'm really interested in, could you describe a little bit more about the relationship between having a thought and then, because you made the distinction earlier about having the thought of jumping from the train but not being suicidal, you didn't want it to happen, you didn't believe. So when you have the thought, is it just a thought or is it like a belief? I have it, it's a belief. And that leads on to behaviour because you believe you have it or you believe it's there, so you change your behaviour. Or is it sort of I'm just trying to understand the difference between just having a thought, like, having a song stuck in your head on repeat. I mean, that's annoying, it can drive you insane, but it's not,
it's a good, I understand. So yeah. It's a good question. People can have negative thoughts. So you can be, maybe you've got a job interview tomorrow and you're anxious about it. That has a negative effect on you, but it's completely normal to be anxious about a job interview because you know that you want to get the job, and the reason you want to get the job is that you want status, or maybe you've got to feed the family. And so that chimes with the kind of person that you want to be. The technical term for those are egosyntonic thoughts. They're kind of in harmony with the kind of person we would want to be perceived as. So although you might feel anxious, you don't question why you have that thought. The thoughts in OCD are different. They're called ego dystonic, and they clash with the kind of person we want to be. And that's often because I know now that I cannot catch HIV in these circumstances. I'm a rational, scientific person. I interviewed the guy who discovered HIV once. I know my way around a virology paper. I understand risk. It's completely irrational that I'm anxious that this is actually true. At lunchtime today, my 5-year-old daughter came back from school. She'd been stung by a wasp. She had a big thing here. She's in all sorts of tears. A little part of my head said, well, maybe someone stabbed her with a hypodermic syringe. Completely irrational. Those thoughts bother people for two reasons. One, I was anxious that she might have HIV because someone stabbed her with a hypodermic needle. But also, that's ridiculous. Why am I thinking that? What kind of person thinks that? And so there's double the distress. There's the anxiety caused by the thought, and there's the anxiety just by having that thought. And that's when people, when it's the thought about harming the child, not only is it the fear of harming the child, but it questions, what kind of parent am I that has these thoughts? And so that's why they're ego-dystonic, because they clash. No one would want to be seen as the kind of person who thinks about drowning a child. Whereas most people would like to be thought of as someone that gets anxious about a job interview because you're conscientious and you're taking it seriously.
Thanks. I'm really interested in the historical research that you did for your book. I'm afraid I haven't read it, but I'm really curious about whether there are particular... I mean, you cite that there are examples of people having obsessive thoughts, and suggest various people at various different times, but can you chart moments when there are more people who seem to have these thoughts, and perhaps are they linked at all to changing diagnostic categories?
I think... We put a man on the moon before we realised that most people have these thoughts. You know, it was in 1970s. There was a psychiatrist at the Maudsley Hospital, and he was called Jack Ratman, and he was working with these obsessive patients, and he tried behavioural therapy, it didn't work, couldn't understand what was driving these people, what was wrong with them. And then he was saying to one of his colleagues, you know, because they have these crazy thoughts about, you know, having sex with a dog. And the colleague kind of, I went, what? They said, I have thoughts like that as well. And nobody knew. And they did a survey. They surveyed the people with OCD, and they surveyed the psychiatrists and secretaries and friends of those people who worked at the Maudsley Hospital. And they wrote down lists of the kind of weird thoughts that they had, and then they mixed them up. And they gave them to the best psychiatrists and said, separate which of those thoughts came from people with OCD or which came from people who treat people with OCD. And they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. Until then, that was 1977, until then, we did not know that everybody has these weird thoughts because we don't talk about them. And that's why you only tend to hear or to read about reports of them when those thoughts change into the disorder, the problem, because then people get so distressed by it that it overcomes the fear of saying to people, "Hi, I have, you know, fears of, I just see giant penises everywhere. Sorry, it's really bothering me."
Gosh,
that's in the book. That book I talked about with Marjorie Kemp, the autobiography. That's what she describes. You know, and people like Martin Luther, John Bunyan, serious religious figures had obsessive thoughts about worshipping the devil. You know, I mean, can you imagine what it would take someone in that situation to own up to that? And so, we don't know how many people have these thoughts and whether those thoughts have increased because people don't talk about them and don't tell us. We only know when it's got to the point it's got so bad that they are treated and people will write down case studies. Or when people do these surveys. So people will go out now and ask people about these weird thoughts. And when they do, it comes back time and time and time again. 95% of people will say, actually, yeah, I have those.
I mean, to be fair, I mean, Sigmund Freud, you know, did actually suggest that it was quite normal for so-called healthy people to have all sorts of weird thoughts. I mean, I don't think that you could say that it took a control group of Maudsley psychiatrists who in themselves are probably not altogether.
I think this was a specific,
yes,
they're called intrusive thought, so there's ego dystonic thought.
But Freud was full of examples of that.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it is. Yeah.
I'm going to be really cheeky and ask a very quick question, but there's a lady over there, and then you answer that. But one thing that's interesting about the idea of ego-syntonic thoughts is, and ego-dystonic thoughts is the idea that there are thoughts that we have that are rational and thoughts that are irrational. Now, of course, we can say all kinds of things about whether Freud was a scientist or not, and kind of ho-hum. But one thing that's very interesting is that you subscribe to the view that a scientist is someone who takes something that's apparently irrational and discovers law and logic and order to it. So I wondered to what extent you would agree with the claim that these thoughts are irrational and whether that in itself is scientific or not.
There's a guy called Kurt Gödel, who was a mathematician, and he was a friend and contemporary of Albert Einstein. He worked at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton. He was a seriously bright guy. His branch of mathematics was rationality and logic, and the limits of it. So he devoted his entire career to understanding rationality and the limits of rationality. And he had an obsessive thought, an irrational thought, that he might be poisoned. He was worried that gas might escape from his fridge and kill him. He was worried that his food might be poisoned. He got his wife to taste all of his food before he ate. You won't laugh in a minute. You won't laugh in a minute. He got his wife to taste all the food before he ate it. This guy went out for lunch with Albert Einstein, and he's thinking, oh, I don't want to eat that sandwich because someone might have poisoned it. Give it to my wife. They're like, okay, I'll... She became ill, not because of eating his food. She became ill, went into hospital, couldn't do it. He starved himself to death. That is the power of these thoughts. Whether they're called, whether we call them irrational, whether we call them rational, what's wrong, you know,
this is where
those are cultural labels.
This is where it gets all into the... There's a huge overlap there, obviously, between paranoia. Paranoid.
But the difference between paranoid delusions is that he knew they were irrational thoughts. I know that I can't catch HIV. There are people who are like hypochondriacs who are genuinely convinced that they can catch it in these ways. I know that I can't. So this comes from, I'm going to quote Latin now. The word obsess comes from the Latin obsidere, which is used to mean besiege. And so in old-fashioned military operations, to obsess a city was to surround it, but not to have taken control. And when you had invaded and taken control and killed everybody, you had possessed the city. And the distinction remains. To be obsessed, to have OCD, you have to be resisting an external force. You resist. If you're a paranoid schizophrenic, you have delusions, you don't resist those because you genuinely believe the CIA is beaming messages into your brain. You believe that. You lose touch with reality. I haven't lost touch with reality. I'm very aware that I'm doing this to myself, that it's completely irrational, and yet I can't stop it.
Isn't that a definition of the unconscious?
Well, someone who is a paranoid schizophrenic, those thoughts are also coming from the unconscious.
Yeah.
And yet they're not aware of it, whereas I'm aware of it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for doing this talk. It's really, really interesting. My experience with this talk so far is some people are a little bit DBT, some people are a little bit psychodynamic, analytical, and the way that OCD presents is so nuanced and complex, such a difficult condition to treat. What's stopping CBT and psychoanalysts working together to make a super hybrid baby of healthy?
What a good idea.
Well, I think that is very much happening, actually. I certainly have been influenced by some of the techniques in CBT. And I think that actually David Clark,
the man who spread CBT everywhere, you know, is admitting that it has a very limited efficacy, but on the other hand, that it does do the job in the sense that it can, with a proportion of about 40% of cases of depression and anxiety, it does, they tick the boxes at the end of the succession. 60% don't. But I think so he's aware that there's severe limitations to what he's doing. And equally, I think that the psychoanalytic community are increasingly waking up to the fact that they can't just sort of, you know, sit back and say, you know, tell me about your dreams and lie on the couch and we've gone doing this 5 days a week for the rest of the time. That way of thinking is out, and there is a much greater, I mean, indeed in the Anna Freud Center, Peter Fonagy is the head of the Anna Freud Center, and he is very much in break. He created something called MBT, which is a hybrid, very much a hybrid. Peter, you know, I have a very high regard for Peter, but I think he's embraced CBT a little. He's hugging it a little bit more passionately than I might do. But nonetheless, you know, hats off to him. You know, he's trying to find a way to, yeah, try and navigate the way forward so that you end up with the best possible hybrid. I think that's really a true point.
Brilliant question. And I write about science for a living, right? And I thought that the astronomers hated the particle physicists, right? Because they fight over the money, and astronomers want to build huge telescopes, particle physicists want to build huge atom smashers, and they can't do both. And so one says that's pointless, one says that's pointless. That is nothing compared to the territorial disputes that go on between psychologists, clinical psychologists, psychiatrists, psychodynamic therapists. Within psychiatry, there are people who are, you know, believe in it's all down to brain circuitry. There are people who think it's all down to chemistry. There are people who and the reason for that is because they're all making it up. Nobody knows. And so it's politics. I mean, psychiatry was invented as a way of gaining political power. The French did it because they, this is a rather general statement, but bear with me. The French psychiatrist wanted, or the psychologist wanted, the status that the surgeons and the doctors had. And the way they did it was they said, okay, we're going to invent an insanity defense for the law courts, and we're the only people who get to decide. That's our job. We're important now. We have a role. And they invented the insanity defense. They invented something called monomania, which is one of the ways people thought about OCD. And it's gone on. You know, right now there's big fights between people who want to spend the money looking at the genetics of mental illness, the genetic or brain scans. Even within the mental illness community, you know, there's a bipolar camp, there's a schizophrenia camp. People got into trouble and they said, well, let's just look at psychosis. No, you can't do that. You have to look at bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. There's an American Psychiatric Association, there's an American Psychological Association, they're both called the APA, which is really confusing. Neither of them will back down. I'm not making this up. I'm not making this up. So, what you suggested would require all of that to be unpicked.
But I think unofficially it is happening. There's a tremendous amount of preparedness on both sides, really, to admit that they haven't got the answer. I think that's true.
I think
it's getting much better.
Yeah,
it's getting a lot better.
That was basically what I was going to ask. But I do wonder that with things like CBT, and I suppose the fact that I survived past the year 2007, I'm in this room right now, I am something, I'm by some means a success story. I'll assume there's other people in the room who have a similar impact on. But the problem is with things like CBT is with its kind of vaguely Orwellian terms, with capital R reassurance and all that sort of stuff, it does make you quite dogmatic. And it makes you quite brutal. I've been over the past 2 years when people have suggested to me that perhaps other forms are available and other forms might even make me yet more of a person free from compulsion and intrusive thoughts. I just wondered what you thought about that.
Well, I think you're right. I think I am...
Scientologists would probably say the same thing I would, you know, and they're obviously horrible.
They would, but if you said...
Nasty about Scientology.
I think, you know, if you...
Come and get it.
If someone was to wave a magic crystal around and then you felt better, you would think you would trust that and you would argue with that, because no matter how much we like to think of ourselves as rational, evidence-based individuals, we go on our own experiences. And the job of science and of evidence-based medicine is to take all those experiences and add them all together and average them out. Now, that has flaws and problems, because you don't treat the average population, you treat individuals. But we've moved on from waving crystals. We look at evidence and efficacy and all those words which cover populations rather than individuals. And I think, so that is my answer to that, is that we should then, given that we have scant resources, which we do, for mental illness and the treatment of mental illness, we should direct that not towards the people waving crystals who someone says they feel better, but to the therapies which the evidence of lots and lots of people suggest are the best ones. And I get, is that dogma? I don't know. I mean, some people say that's scientific dogma, evidence-based dogma. But I think dogma is argument without evidence, and I would argue that there is evidence for CBT.
Yeah, but no CBT. I mean, the thing is that you've got to look at who decides what the money is spent on. In terms of what studies, so there is something like 45 times more money spent on biogenic genes, neurological explanation of mental illness than on environmental explanation of mental illness.
Yeah.
And that's it, yeah. I mean, that's in terms of causality, but certainly CBT is obviously, you know, I know Richard Lael from way back, and he's played a blinder, you know, and obviously the clinical psychology profession, he played it blind as well in terms of, you know, creating themselves as a profession, getting a lot of power and having a big influence on how some research money is spent. And so, yeah, at the moment, you know, the ball's in their court. But, you know, I think it, in terms of your question, I think CBT does encourage you in its worst forms, in higher scheduled CBT done by quite poorly trained individuals, does really end up with some quite, I think, potentially very disturbing interventions where you're really asking people to call black white and sort of brainwashing them into saying that they're happy when they're not, and getting them at the, you know paid for by Gordon Brown originally and still encouraged by David Cameron, trying to get people to go back and put a smile on their faces, they go and work in Tesco's and stop costing the state money. That's what it was really originally sold as, the depression report, Richard Lael's thing. Of course, that hasn't worked out at all. It turns out that they've virtually saved no money at all in that sense. But that isn't to, you know, that isn't to belittle it. And I think that in terms of the sort of dogmatism of the cognitive therapeutic community, I think it's probably no worse than the psychodynamic. I mean, and it says I've done my best to give a display of Dave's spark-like dogmatism this evening. You know, I like to think I've done my little bit to show psychodynamic psychotherapists can be pretty bigoted too. You know. but you know, it's not exclusive to CBT or anything.
Out for end now. Can I just ask one last question? What was the music you were listening to on the day?
Jane's Addiction. They're a band. They're an LA band. yeah, it was. It's in the book.
Oh, no.
I won't It's a long story. And it's better read than listened to.
At that point, I do appreciate that we've overrun a tiny bit. I know that David, and I think Oliver as well, you have to do it, hang around in case that people want books signed.
Yes, of course.
If you haven't got already, we are selling books at the back. Thank you so much for coming, and please come and give a big round of applause.